Hello and welcome to Untangled Resolution's presentation of The Problem is the Answer, a weekly radio show about maximizing your communication skills. I am your host, Batabile Mtombeni, relationship mediator and conflict coach, coming to you from Harlem, USA. This week we discuss how financial literacy can help you to have financially healthy relationships. Get ready to call in with your questions and comments. 818-532-9789. This week's featured artist is singer-songwriter Malika Zahra. She is called the Jewel of Morocco, and soon you will know why. Take a listen, and I'll tell you more after this break. Enjoy. Welcome again to the show. You've been listening to Malika Zahra, who is called the Moroccan Jazz Jewel. And you're listening to music from her debut solo album called The Ebony Road. Malika is releasing a brand new album called Border Taxi next month. The album release party will be April 19th at the Jazz Standard here in New York City. So if you're around, you surely don't want to miss that. I'll be sharing more music from her later on, but I hope that you're enjoying this music from Morocco. We have a full show today. We are talking about money. Money, money, money. It's all about the Benjamins. And fights over money are a leading reason that long-term relationships break up. It is vital that couples share a common understanding of their finances and their financial goals. So you need to be able to talk together and understand together what you want to happen with your money, when you are involved in a long-term relationship, especially where you have commingled your funds. And so that's why I am so pleased to welcome our first guest. My first guest on the show ever is Dominique Rees. She is a financial advisor and a financial educator, and she is the founder and CEO of Community LLC. And this is a company that is dedicated to teaching financial literacy to individuals and families and youth. So she'll bring you very important information about how you can improve your relationship by improving your financial literacy. And we're going to welcome her to the show a little later. But first, I want to congratulate you for being here at this time, just in general, because even I am not sure exactly what time it is. For those of you who are not in the United States, and those of you who live in the saner parts of the United States, most of the rest of the United States started observing daylight saving time at 2 o'clock this morning. And that means that we shift our clocks an hour forward. And so I was actually awake this morning when the clock went from 1:59 in the morning to 3 o'clock. It just jumped 2 o'clock completely. So I'm an hour off, and I had to spend some time with my sister this morning trying to figure out just exactly when we should all gather for the radio show. So I congratulate you for being here, for setting your clocks forward. But, you know, I still don't understand the need. I don't understand the need for this daylight saving time, especially when we lose an hour. It's just so rough. And I have this to say about it. I mean, really, you know, 80 years ago and then however time it's been since Lincoln made that speech, the founders of this great nation came together and they decided to free themselves from tyranny. They decided to found a new nation based on freedom and on choice. And they enshrined this in that wonderful, marvelous document called the Constitution of the United States. And the Constitution of the United States contains the Bill of Rights. And in the Bill of Rights, you have there your rights to choose. You can choose to speak, or you can choose to remain silent. You can choose to worship, or you can choose not to worship. You can choose to bare your arms or to keep them covered up. And I'm saying that they forgot one thing. They forgot one thing, and they forgot to include the choice not to participate in daylight savings time. And so I am saying to you, rise up. Rise up against this tyranny of daylight savings time and stand up for choice. We should choose. We should be able to choose whether we turn our clocks forward or not, so that when you come in late tomorrow morning at work, you won't actually be late. You'll just be exercising your freedom to choose whether or not you participate in daylight savings time. Now, some of you may get fired. Some of you may get nasty looks from the people who expect you to be there. But revolution requires sacrifice, my brothers and sisters. Sacrifice. And that too is your choice. So if you do get fired or you do get nasty looks, don't come back to me about it, because you know it's your choice. That's all I'm saying. I'm saying we should be able to choose. And I choose to sleep in tomorrow morning. That's right. We all ought to be able to choose. Now, on a much more important note, you know, I'm kind of being silly about that, but on a much more important note, the human family has suffered a serious blow this last week. The Japanese part of our family was hit with a 1-2 punch that just keeps on hitting. They were hit with an earthquake so powerful, our earth has been hit with an earthquake that's so powerful, that it moved the Japanese coast. It's been reported that it's moved the coast about 8 feet. And according to some reports, it has tilted the earth's axis about 9 centimeters. And that's no joke. But beyond that, there's the human toll. Thousands are dead and missing. You know, we don't know what the toll is yet. And in terms of just the human experience of such a disaster, our people in Japan need our help. And they need our support. So be it the Red Cross, be it some other organization, find a way to contribute to be part of that family that needs you at this moment. So I encourage everybody to do what you can to help out the folks in Japan. All right, so we've had a quick intro. I want the show to focus on our guest for today. So we're going to take a big, quick break. And then when we get back, we'll be talking with Dominique Rees about your financial health. You are listening to Untangled Resolutions, broadcast of The Problem is the Answer. And this is Malika Zara singing All the Same, an original song from her debut album, The Ebony Road. I'll be back in just a moment.
Hey, yeah, lay, 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 lay,
hey, yeah, lay, 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 lay
All right, we're back. And if you're just joining us, you are listening to Untangled Resolution's presentation of The Problem is the Answer, a weekly radio show about communicating. I am your host, Batabi Lipumtombeni, the mediator, coming to you live from Harlem, USA. Untangled Resolutions is a mediation and conflict coaching firm. In mediation, you judge your own outcomes. Visit www.123untangled.com or write to info@123untangled.com to get more information about what mediation can do for you. You were listening just now to Malika Zahra, and the song title that you were listening to is All the Same, and it's from her debut album called The Ebony Road. Malika is just about to put out a new album next month in April, and it's called Border Taxi. It will be available. And speaking of music, I want you to know that I've been enjoying the 9th annual Lady Got Chops Women's Music Month and Arts Festival very, very much. And no, again, I'm not going to read that whole list. But if you go to the chat room, the chairman of the chat room will put up the link to the website that gives you all of the remaining shows for the festival coming up for the rest of the month. Last night I was at Zinc Bar and really enjoyed hearing Kelly Powers, who's a jazz pianist, play with Sherelle Cassidy on alto sax, Linda O on bass, and Norman Edwards on drums. Kelly tells me that she got special permission from the organizer of the festival, Kim Clark, to have Norman Edwards join the group as a drummer. So we had our fantastic gentleman join the ladies last evening at Zinc Bar, and it was really wonderful. So again, I encourage you, if you are in New York City, go to the website, check out the venues and the times, and make sure to go to at least one of the events this month. You won't be sorry. All right, so we are coming to the part of the show that you've really been listening for. I have our guest, Dominique Reese, here. She is the founder and CEO of Communitree LLC, a company that is dedicated to helping its clients improve their finances. And I'm going to put Dominique on the show, and I'm going to tell you, this is a historic moment. Let's talk, you know, about speaking correct English here. This is an historic moment. This is our first time that we're having a guest on the show. So I'm still kind of testing out the technology. We're going to see how this works. But with all organic processes, I'm sure that you will all bear with us as we embark on this brave new journey of having a guest here on the show. So, Dominique, are you there?
Hey, Bitabale, can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Right. And, you know, I have to let you all know who are listening that Dominique has done a marvelous thing. She is such a professional. She's literally just stepped off a plane from Los Angeles, and she is here and ready to do the show.
Yes.
I'm so amazed. I have to tell you, I was biting my nails a little bit about that. How was your trip?
It was absolutely wonderful. The session went very, very well. So I'm really pleased.
All right. That's right. What were you doing in L.A.?
I teach middle school students about college once a month, and I've been doing that since December. So March was our fourth session, and I flew out. We taught at USC this time and spent the day teaching middle school students about college, and the session just went really well. We had 62 students show up of about 170. So that's been our average for a while, but it went very, very well. So I'm really pleased with the outcome.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, it's so important that people learn early, young people learn early what they need to do in order to be successful when they are applying to college.
Absolutely.
Right. So, listen, I would like to get into a little bit about your background and what brought you to your profession. What inspired you to become a financial advisor?
Well, in high school, I was introduced to a program that provided scholarships, mentorships, and internships. And through that particular program, one of my mentors was a financial advisor. Prior to this, I'd always managed my allowance as a teenager. So I was always interested in how money worked and how it facilitated transactions. But, you know, I've been managing my own allowance and trying to make sure that I could get the things that I wanted ever since a teenager, so I've always been kind of interested. But one of my mentors in high school was a financial advisor with Merrill Lynch. And through the program, you know, he offered me an internship, and I took it and was really introduced to the world of finance through that internship. He's a financial advisor, so it was private wealth management at that. And I got to see how people, you know, manage their money and using investments in the stock market, and I figured, you know, this is something that really interests me, but I think I can do this. So I, you know, took an interest in financial advising, and out of college, got my full-time job with Merrill Lynch as a marketing analyst, but decided to transfer to private wealth management in 2007. And at that time, I joined a team in New York City at the world headquarters of Merrill Lynch, and managed about $4 million assets and liabilities.
Wow.
On that team. Yeah. And really was, you know, learning the business and understanding what it took, but at the same token, helping people to achieve their financial dreams and goals. And from that perspective, felt really good about that and was, you know, getting good at it. I used education as a way to prospect clients as well. So I would hold seminars, and people would attend the seminars to learn about different strategies or whatever the particular topic was. But on my team, I was a financial planning specialist. So I was used to going out, finding clients, and then gathering data from them about their current situation and what they wanted to accomplish financially, what was preventing them from doing that, and then really coming up with a set of solutions and a strategy to help them reach those financial goals. And once we did that, you know, people were able to see what it took to go from A to B and then accomplish that goal, and then B to C and accomplish that goal. So you take steps, and the financial journey is really a journey.
Okay.
So that was really what got me in the business and got me interested.
So you've really been at this for quite some time, I mean, since you were a teenager.
Yes, really. My experience goes back there. That's what I reference, and that's what I think about in terms of really, you know, kind of giving me the experience of managing money from a young age compared to when, you know, most people would just spend and, you know, get more money and spend. I actually kind of wanted to manage it because there were things that I wanted to do. So by nature, you know, the management was part of the training.
Was there someone in your life that inspired you to do that before you met your mentor who was, I guess you'd said, was at Merrill Lynch? But prior to that time, I mean, it seems it came naturally to you to manage your money?
Yeah, you know, interestingly enough, my father passed away when I was very young. And as a result of that, there was a settlement from that particular situation. So I was getting money, you know, from that, but my grandfather would use it to take care of me. So that allowed me to have an allowance. And, you know, all of my needs were met for the most part, but I was able to have the privilege of having a little allowance. I want to say it was probably like $30 a week that I would get, you know, while I was in high school. And from $30 a week, I learned how to either save it, you know, also save my lunch money. You know, saving the lunch money was key as well, because that added to the weekly allowance. But I did have chores. I had to earn it. So I understood the value of a dollar from a very young age, because although, you know, I had this settlement that was taking care of my needs, if he felt like I didn't earn it, he wouldn't give it to me. So it wasn't something that was necessarily promised, but I would do my weekly chores, clean my room, clean the bathroom, clean the kitchen. That's what I was responsible for. I'd get my $30, and, hey, that was that. But I also had a job in high school starting in the 11th grade. So I think the combination of those things, having access to an allowance, which, you know, some kids may or may not have access to, but being also fortunate enough to experience the value of a dollar and management of an allowance at a young age.
Right, right. Well, I'm so sorry to hear about your father passing away, but it sounds like your
grandfather. Pardon? I said, no problem. That's, you know, it's part of life.
It certainly is. It's an unfortunate part of life, but your grandfather, it sounds like, really did step in and did quite a good job with you. And I noticed that with your company, you do have a focus on working with young people, with youth. Tell me a little bit more about how you started your company and the services that you provide.
Absolutely. So Communitree LLC was born out of really a bittersweet moment. I unfortunately was laid off in 2009, January 2009, right after, you know, Merrill Lynch was bought by Bank of America, and they got rid of our program, so I was out of a job, and I did not include layoff in my five-year plan, so that was kind of interesting, but the way that the market was going as well, just, you know, there was something that needed to change, so it was unfortunate, but then, hey, my company was born out of it, so in May, I decided to just basically pick up from where I left off with my practice at Merrill, which was teaching people in order to prospect, you know, find more clients, but also as a way of really servicing those who didn't have the investable assets who were ready to go right away. So I felt like, okay, well, I can provide the education, you know, whether they have the money or not, they can attend, it's free. But if they did have something that they could work with and wanted to do, you know, invest in the market or get some counsel around, hey, I'm right there, perfect prospecting tool. And with Communitree, I figured when I was a financial advisor with Merrill Lynch, I wasn't able to always service the clients that I wanted to service simply because they didn't have the investable assets and were ready to go. So with Communitree, I'm now able to service the clients I want, which were a market that were completely being overlooked in the financial advising, you know, industry, in my opinion. You either had to have a certain amount of money, which was usually, you know, $100,000, $250,000 to play with Merrill Lynch. But at the same token, any financial advisor, you know, they have to be able to manage a certain amount in order to make a certain amount. Mm-hmm. And so those thresholds could be relatively high. And most people just don't have that money ready to invest. So it really limited who I could work with and who I seemed to have an affinity to work with because they wanted to work with me, I think, because I was willing to teach them first and manage their money second. And I think that was key in the process of even just teaching people about wealth management. So Communitree was born out of a desire to service clients who were being overlooked, but also provide very basic financial education, which meant, you know, budgeting, emergency fund strategies, and debt reduction strategies, because I found that even though you may have been a millionaire or, you know, had hundreds of thousands of dollars in the market, you still had substantial debt, and you were still living outside your means, and you probably didn't have much savings outside of, you know, what was in the market. So those were very common characteristics of people with money and people with no money. So that's the things that we do at Communitree. We provide three particular services. One is financial literacy sessions to youth and adults. So we teach in group settings, companies, nonprofits, schools, churches, you know, any organization or entity that has a desire to teach their constituents, members, participants about financial education can hire us to come in and do that. And we encourage that we do it over a series so that the education is comprehensive. And then the second service we provide is the individual money management counseling. That's one-on-one counseling with a financial educator. We don't provide financial advice. We provide financial counsel and financial education. So we consider ourselves to be financial counselors in the sense that you come to us usually, unfortunately, people do seek our services when they're in the financial crisis, and we want to prevent that with the education. So, you know, usually it's I'm living paycheck to paycheck. I have no savings. I'm making money, but I don't know where it's going. I have substantial debt or, you know, student loans. I need a strategy because payments are going to kick in soon. We see things like that, and we help clients with, one, the budgeting, because you really can't understand where you're going unless you know where you are. So that's what a budget helps to provide. And then you have, second, the emergency fund strategy, because if all hits the fan, you need to be able to know that you can float for a few months, you know, before things can stabilize. And then third is the debt. Usually people have substantial or modest debt that they, if they got rid of it, it would open up doors rather than it preventing doors for their financial goals and dreams. So we provide those three services and strategies around how to get those things in order. And lastly, it's a financial education development service, where an organization says, hey, Dominique, we want to create our own financial education platform based on the needs of our, you know, constituents, members, clients, and from there, you know, incorporate financial principles from your curriculum. So can you customize a platform specifically for our organization? And that will be the third service that we provide at Community LLC.
Wow. That is really comprehensive. I mean, you know, I've known you for a while, but hearing this in that concentrated form really demonstrates to me the power of being able to come to Community and work with you, even when you don't really have the kinds of funds that you would think, conventionally speaking, that a person would have for them to hire or take on the services of a financial advisor. And, you know, another thing that I'm really impressed with is that you have quite a track record of turning diamonds from coal, you know, making diamonds out of coal. You know, your
Thank
father
you.
Passing away and then being laid off at a time that was, and still is, you know, the financial situation is still pretty grim. It's still pretty difficult. But 2009 was just sort of the cusp of it. And
Absolutely.
So, you know, to take that kind of event and grow out of it something that is this important and add so much to the community, you know, that's really amazing what it is that you've been able to do. I'm
Thank
really
you.
Interested.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm interested in looking at this issue of having no investable assets, because I have a sense that a lot of the listeners to the show, a lot of my listeners, will consider themselves to be in that situation, especially considering the financial situation right now, that they don't have investable assets, that they are living from paycheck to paycheck. And yet you're saying that even in that situation, a financial advisor can be useful.
Absolutely. As mentioned, what I realized was, you know, there's this market out there of people who, just because they are not ready to invest doesn't mean they don't have financial needs and don't have financial goals and dreams. And what I found was people who came to those seminars that I would conduct were people with no investable assets, still wanted the education, still had the need. And so it's like, okay, well, who's servicing them? Not many people. So, and that's, you know, most people are in that situation. So the market is much, much, much larger. And for me, I'm thinking, well, not only is there opportunity, but there's an opportunity to really start to change the way we look at our relationship with money and how we use it, the facilitation, because I don't think as many people were accomplishing financial goals and dreams as much as they are being consumers. So it's just always consuming things rather than achieving things.
Right. And, you know, you're actually leading me into what will be the next part of our conversation, which is about the nitty-gritty, you know, the specifics of the kinds of issues that you find when you're working with people, especially with families and with couples. So we're going to take a break, a really quick break here. But when we come back, I want to talk with you about specifically the kinds of issues that you have encountered as you work with folks and the kinds of mistakes, the common mistakes that you have seen people making with their finances. So we're going to be back after just a moment. I'm going to turn you over again to Malika Zara. The album is called The Ebony Road, and the song that you are going to hear is called Pouvoir. I have no idea whether I'm pronouncing that correctly. My French is just beyond awful. But, and I have a friend in Germany who's rolling around on the floor light right now because there is a whole long kind of joke about the fact that I should not speak French. However, the name of the song is called Pouvoir, Malika Zara, and we'll be back in just a moment.
I'm
All right, we're back. Sorry for the delay there, folks. I'm having a little bit of technical difficulty, but it's all good. If you're just joining us, I am Batabi Levantombini, and you are listening to Untangled Resolutions' presentation of The Problem is the Answer, a weekly radio show about communicating. I'm coming to you live from Harlem, USA. Untangled Resolutions is a mediation and conflict coaching firm. In mediation, you judge your own outcome. Visit www.123untangled.com or write to info@123untangled.com to get more information about what mediation can do for you. And you were just listening to Malika Zahra, and she's called the Moroccan Jazz Jewel. The music you're listening to on the show today is from her debut solo album called The Ebony Road. And I'm really happy to announce that Malika will be releasing her newest album. It's called Border Taxi, and it will be available in April. There is a listening party, or a release party, actually, on the 19th of April at the Jazz Standard. So if you are in New York City around that time, be sure to check that out. Beautiful music from Malika Zahra. Now, I have with me on the show today my first guest ever. I'm so pleased to be welcoming Dominique Rees, who is the CEO and the founder and CEO of Communitree LLC. This is a company that is dedicated to teaching financial literacy to its clients and to helping clients to improve their financial standing. So we talked a bit, Dominique, about your background and what brought you to found your company and about the services that you provide. And now I'd like you to talk a bit about the specific issues that you find people tend to deal with when they get into financial trouble. What are the common issues that arise when you work with your clients?
Well, usually when a client seeks our counsel and our help, it's for a few reasons. What the most common ones that I've seen are, one, they're living outside their means just generally, which creates a whole host of other problems. They are using debt to inflate their income. So, you know, high credit card debt, or not even high, but modest, and modest enough such that, you know, they find out, well, I've made $60,000, but I've spent $80,000. How did that happen? How is that possible? Mm-hmm. Well, you're probably using credit cards at some point, and really the interest that, you know, that carries has inflated everything. So there's substantial debt to consider. And then they're not educated on the basics of investing. So there's a complete lack of knowledge about the benefits of investing, which also leads to a lack of not taking on risk, but doing risky things with their money. So it's a really interesting dichotomy there to see that you're not taking on any risk, but the behavior that you have is fairly risky in, you know, relative to the dreams and the goals that you're trying to accomplish financially. So those are some of the most common themes that I find in the clients that we work with.
But, you know, thank you very much for that explanation. This show really is about communication and about relationships, and I was really interested in the issue of financial trouble being a leading cause of breakups in relationships. Is there anything in particular that happens with couples that you can talk about, mistakes perhaps that couples make?
Absolutely. Well, usually there's, you know, because there's two people involved in the situation, obviously separate finances are something to consider. And if, depending on the status of the relationship, you know, how long one has been dating another and the seriousness of the relationship in general, if you're at a point which you should be sharing information about your finances and you're not, that's usually what leads to the lack of communication around what's really happening in the individual lives of each partner. And because there seems to just be an assumption about some things or just a lack of understanding altogether, you know, the longer you're with someone, your feelings grow for them, but you're not growing together financially, just like, you know, they talk about growing spiritually, talking about growing professionally, talking about growing socially. There's all these other areas that you can manage individually, but with the finances, you know, when you're trying to manage a relationship, that becomes key, because obviously you have to consider marriage if it's that serious, or if you're engaged, so marriage would be the next step. And the things that really can hurt a relationship are things like debt, because when you're trying to come together as one, you know, you've got to consider all those outstanding things that affect you individually. So I'd say that high debt in particular can be a sore point. But if you flip the script and say, well, what if, you know, you're just an average couple with not much debt, but you're not making much money either. You love the person that you're dating, or you're feeling them to a certain extent, and, you know, is it appropriate to delve into one's financial life on that level? And I say yes, simply because, you know, if you're ever going to borrow money from your boyfriend or your girlfriend, or, you know, you're even considering about taking it up to the next level, then you should really take it to the next level on all levels, including financially. So even in a relationship that's not as mature, you should still have a sense of how responsible, financially responsible, the person you're dating is going to be or is practicing, because that could definitely be a factor in whether you stay with them, but at the same token, the financial health of the relationship. So the lack of communication is key from early, because it allows you to practice talking this way. You know, money is a very sensitive topic.
For
and
sure.
You go from managing it individually and knowing all the deep down secrets and knowing all the things that even you as an individual may know that, okay, if I continue this behavior, I'm not going to be in the best financial situation, or I'm making money, I have a good job, but I'm not saving. So I need to, you know, instill that habit and get discipline. So even if it's minimal things such as just realizing I don't have that characteristic and I need to obtain it, or I've got some serious problems in this relationship with this person who I'm really feeling, and yeah, this is going to come up at some point. So I feel like communication from very early can help to facilitate the behavior that's necessary, and really just avoid all of it. And I say debt is probably, you know, one of the most pressing issues, because it really makes a difference when those two things come together.
Right, right. Wow, powerful. And that is really important. You talk about getting involved early in having discussions about finances, and the shift from thinking as one person managing finances to now thinking as a team managing finances. You know, there's a recurrent theme in what you've said, and it has to do with goal setting. And when you first mentioned goal setting, the thought that came to my mind was, well, how do I know what goals to set? So what do you tell people about having goals to set and what kinds of goals they need to consider?
I love talking about this portion because it's very, very simple, and most people think it's more complicated than it really is. When I meet a client and you find out what's happening in this situation, after all that's said and done, usually when I ask this question in particular, I get a pause, or I get, well, you know, I really haven't thought about that. And the question is, what are your financial goals? Most people don't have any, simply because they've never really considered that they should. Because if you set a goal to lose weight, you pretty much know how to do it. It's just a discipline. And it's the exact same thing with your money. If you even just set a goal, you'll kind of see and understand the path that's necessary to get there. So, for example, you know, I want to save $1,000 at the end of the year. Okay, well, that's a great goal to have, and it's a goal that, you know, anyone should really set. But to begin, you got to see where you stand, and then from there you'll start to chart out, okay, what I need to do, or certain timelines I need to make, or, you know, how much can I actually afford to save? That's probably another question that most people don't realize they have to ask whenever setting savings goals in particular. Savings goals are ambitious, but if it's unrealistic, you can forget it. So when setting these goals, you have to be sure that you're doing it realistically and you're not basing it upon what the status quo is. I don't believe that
Dominique, I'm sorry if you can hear me. I'm having trouble with your hearing you with your phone. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Barely. I think your connection is going to come back in just a second. It went faded out a little bit. You may have to back up and repeat what you just said. Nope, it hasn't improved. I'm going to need to ask you to move to someplace else, perhaps. That might do it. Okay, unfortunately, we've experienced one of the technical issues with wireless technology. We've lost Dominique. It looks as though her phone has dropped the call, which is just fine. We're going to get her back on the line in just a minute. In the meanwhile, I'm going to turn you back over to Malika Zara. This is a song called Run, and again, it is from her album called The Ebony Road. We'll be right with you in just a moment. We've got Dominique back, and I'm going to be putting her live on the air in just a moment. So hold on, and hopefully we have her back. Dominique, you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Fantastic. Okay.
Wonderful.
We'll work our way through that one.
Yes. We will work our way through it all.
So we were talking about goal setting and having goals to set, and you were saying something about savings plans, and that it can be great to have a savings plan and ambitious, but it needs to be realistic and based on actual income or actual resources. So let's talk a little bit more about goal setting.
Yeah, so goal setting in particular is necessary. So when you're setting your savings goals, they have to be realistic. If they're not realistic, then you're not going to accomplish them, and it's simply because of your behavior. So once you learn through creating your budget how much you can actually afford to save, that may not be 10% of your income, whereas, you know, they always say save 10% of your income. Well, that may be unrealistic for you. Maybe you need to save 2% of your income or 5% of your income, or maybe you can afford to save 15% of your income, so you should be saving more. But whatever those savings goals are, they have to be realistic. You find out if they're realistic or not based on how much you can afford to save. And how can you figure that out? By using a budget. So that's one way in which, you know, setting goals is important, but there's a process even to that. You got to be sure that they're realistic.
Right, right, absolutely. So in terms of goal setting, one goal is savings. What is another goal that you really suggest that people should have in their list of goals?
Absolutely. There's about two more. One would be the emergency fund savings strategies and setting goals for that, which is included in your savings goals. So that should not be forgotten. An emergency fund savings goal is separate than, like, something else that you're saving for. The emergency fund is exactly that. It's there for emergency purposes only. You know, that layoff that I didn't expect would have been great to have an appropriate, you know, savings, emergency fund savings. So you have to prepare for things that you just truly don't expect. And then another would be the debt. You know, have a debt reduction goal. you want to be able to look at your debt on an annual basis, not just on the monthly basis that you're making those minimum payments. When you do that, you have a tendency to not look at the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is the lower that payment you're making every month, the longer you'll have that debt. So you need to set some goal so that you know what you're working towards, not just, oh, I'll pay it off when I'll pay it off. You know, I'm making my monthly payments. That's really not the behavior that you want in order to accomplish the financial goals and dreams that you have, because it's going to take much longer. And, you know, you don't have that much time to accumulate a certain amount of money. And if you have debt, then the debt is only preventing you twice over from achieving those financial goals and dreams. But also, you're paying someone else. You're now taking on another expense of working very hard for your money and simply giving it to someone else completely based on behavior that could be changed. So setting a debt reduction goal, you know, I want to save $1,000 a year. Well, how about I want to get rid of $1,000 of debt this year? And how will I do that? The exact same way you would do it for savings. Create a budget, understand how much you can even afford to pay. And if it's more than the minimum payments on a lot of your revolving debt, then you should increase those payments by whatever that percentage is. And then you're now working towards that saving, that debt reduction goal of, okay, each month I need to make a minimum payment of X. And, you know, over the life of a year, that would be X amount of dollars. So now I've got a debt reduction goal.
Right. Wow. Excellent. And listen, I want to pause for just a moment to let everybody listening know you will be able to ask Dominique questions yourself. So we're going to be taking calls in just a little bit. We've got a couple more questions that I'd like to pass by Dominique before we take our callers. So please be patient, stay on the line, and we will get to your questions. But before we take questions, I wanted to get some a little bit of detail. You were talking about a savings plan for emergencies, and in this particular economic situation, that is really, really important. Is there a number or, you know, a range that you suggest that people have in terms of their cushion? How much should they have in the bank?
Absolutely. Well, you know, status quo once again says that you should have 3 to 6 months in your of your income in your emergency fund. And really, the 3 to 6 months is okay, if I'm making $1,000 a month, you'll just say that, then I need at least $3,000 in my emergency fund. And, you know, if you can get to that $6,000, then great. But at least $3,000 in my emergency fund. That's, you know, 3 months' income basically saved. And there's a strategy that you have to construct in order to get there. But once again, what if that is unrealistic? What if your expenses are just too high and there's no way that you can save that amount of money in a particular amount of time and, you know, say I have a comfortable emergency fund? So you have to create a strategy around realistic goals, and the way to do that is with the budget. Budget can be the scary process, but it allows you to see what you can and can't do. And based on that, then you can start setting those financial goals and savings goals and debt reduction goals. And once you can do that, then working on the emergency fund will come much easier. Maybe it's not $3,000, but maybe it's $1,500. You know, maybe it's $700. Just to begin to start to save something such that if those little unexpected life events occur, then I wouldn't be in such a financial position that, you know, all the cards fall, because usually that's what happens. Our budgets and our lifestyles are so fragile financially that if you've got an unexpected hospital bill of, you know, $1,200, that would probably really, really shake some things up. So
sure. For
a lot of people, having an emergency fund of $700 could really leave that would dent that $1,200 really well, and only looking at $500 is much better than looking at the $1,200.
So something is much better than nothing.
Something is better than nothing, and that's why I love doing what I do, because it's based on each client's situation. You know, those numbers, they're ambitious. You know, the 3 to 6 months, the saving 10% of your income, they're great, they're ambitious. But for some people, that's just discouraging because they're like, I can't do that, so I might as well not do anything. But no, you've got to do something, and that number is your savings rate. That's your savings rate. It's personal to your situation. And as your situation improves, then you increase the number.
Right. But listen, are you ready to take a caller?
Absolutely. Let's go.
Okay, so we've got somebody in the 412 area code who is on the line. And you can use your name if you want to. You can be anonymous if you want to. It's all up to you, but I'm going to be turning on your mic in just a second. 412 area code, you are on the air. Hello? We got somebody who is on the air. Nope. You know what? I have a feeling it was unintended. Listen, folks, here's something you ought to know. When you call in, if you call in to listen to the show, the number is 818-532-9789. And when you go to the website, you'll see the number there for you to dial in. You can also Skype in if you'd like to. But calling in does not put you in the queue to be on the air. However, if you press the number 1, it will put you in the queue to be on the air. And so I'm going to get a message up on my screen saying that you want to be on the air. There's actually a cute little icon that comes up, and it's a raised hand. And so if you raise your hand, I'm going to put you on the air. So be sure that, you know, you can call in if you like to, so you can listen over your cell phone if you want to, or you can Skype in. But, again, if you hit the number 1, you're going to be placed on the air. So it looks like this was a person who was not expecting to be put on the air, but I do have another caller who is looking to ask a question, and this caller is calling from the 909 area code, and I'm going to be turning on your mic in just a moment. Okay, we're on 909. What is your question? And welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. I do some pastoral counseling, and I have a young couple who are both in school, and they have one child. Their income is very limited. The husband feels that their money should be spent in tuition, and the wife feels that they should sort of, you know, spend some money on furnishings, and they're both dug in their position. How do I deal with this case?
Okay, so that I'm sure it's a couple. They have very low income. They have a child. One partner feels like they should spend money on furnishings, and the other feels like they should spend money on tuition. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, one, they have different goals. So we have to try to get them on the same page around their goals. Clearly, if there's a need to pay tuition, then maybe the need should come before the furnishing. I'm not quite sure what type of furnishings, but, you know, that's just material, whereas the tuition can really impact things like credit score. Also, you know, and I say credit score because if they need to take out any loans, then they're going to have to furnish a credit report to the potential creditor. So we want to start taking a look at the things that can be impacted based on which behavior they choose. Now, you know, if we abandon the tuition idea, not to say that the furnishings aren't important, but if we abandon paying tuition, what are the implications and really what are our goals? So does that align with our goals? So if you can encourage them to each individually list out what financial goals they have individually, this will be really key because it'll just tell you where they are individually, and if they tend to have similar things, then they tend to be on the same page. But if they don't, then they need to start understanding, okay, individually, here's where we are. But we're together, we've got a kid, we've got to set some goals first. And if we, once we set the goals, take a look at the things that we want individually. How can we start to bring those things more into one? So, you know, that could be a very basic exercise that you do with them. Have them list out what they want individually, see if there's some commonalities, and then try to get them on the same page on setting goals together that they can work on.
Oh, that sounds very good. I didn't think about, you know, letting them sort of work on their individual goals and then bring the two together.
Absolutely. Because, good. I mean, you know, as individuals, they're going to want what they want. And if one person feels like, well, I don't want to, you know, compromise what I want, and the other feels, well, I don't want to compromise what I want. So we're still at odds. So we want to try to get them to see that you don't have to abandon your individual goals. Let's see what they are. Let's, if they're reasonable, there should be a way that we can do this together, put my goals with your goals, and create our own as well.
Yeah. That sounds wonderful. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
And thank you so much for calling into the show. I'm going to put your mic on mute, but if you want to hang out and perhaps chime in later on if there's something that interests you, you're free to do that so long as you don't get hung up. So I'm going to put you on hold and see what happens. And if you want to remain available, this, and I'm speaking to the caller, of course, you're free to do so. You know, Dominique, you pointed out something that is really important. I'm thinking, of course, as a mediator, as the caller said, the magic word positions. And people who've been listening to the show regularly will understand that positions is a particular term that mediators use and understand. And so when you're talking about positions, it brings me into the mediator mindset. You talked about making lists of goals. And then looking for commonalities. And you are so right, because it is absolutely a technique that we use in mediation, helping people who are very far apart come to a common understanding. We'll have them list out what their interests and their needs are, and then focus first on the places where their needs and their interests are aligned. And it might be interesting for the couple to see that they really weren't hearing each other until they had their positions listed out and their needs listed out and their interests listed out for them to see that they actually have more in common than they think that they do. So this is something that you use when you are working with your own clients?
Absolutely, and I didn't even realize that it was a term for it. So thank you for educating me about that. But, yeah, you know, it's counseling. It's not just getting the numbers right, but it's also helping people to understand their wants, their desires, and really their goals, but then their behavior. What's driving either the negative behavior or what's driving the aspiration? You know, what's driving me to want these goals? And because I say this, you know, people aren't asked very often, what are your financial goals and dreams? And even though they may say, oh, I want to save. Okay, well, how much do you want to save? There's usually never a number associated with that goal. And you may have heard the saying that, you know, successful people who have goals are more successful than people who don't. But you take it up a notch. Successful people who have goals and who write them down are more successful than people who don't have goals, but also who don't write down their goals. So if you use that as a form of aspiration, you need to have goals, but you also need to write them down. Now, part of the writing is the visual aspect. More people, or most people, are probably visual learners, and so they like to see things. When you make a list of, you know, what you want and what you desire and what your goals are, you can actually see them. It's something that goes from thought to a visual, and then once it's a visual, you start to think about how it looks and what form does that take. Oh, I see myself on the beach once a year, you know, just relaxing in a faraway island and coming back to work being very relaxed and ready to go again. Maybe that's your financial goal, because you want to take vacation once a year, spend about, you know, $3,000 and be able to do that every year. That's a savings goal. That's a financial goal. And more importantly, it's a dream. And we got to get back to people dreaming about having a better financial situation than they are. The living paycheck to paycheck thing is old. You know, we're tired of being burdened with money, something that once we work for it, it's gone. So dreaming about it, setting goals about it, gets us excited. And once you get excited, you got to take that inward look. So once you start that inward look, it's really counseling. What's driving this? And why do I want this? Okay, now how do I get it? Okay, well, where am I? Ah, now I see how I need to get there. It just crystallizes the whole process, what we would call a wealth management process, but really asset building process.
Right, right. Wow, so important. I'm imagining myself on the beach now.
Like, me
well,
too.
That's definitely a goal. That's a goal, yes. I really want to have. You know, as you were talking there, you were talking about, you know, wealth management and, you know, using your assets. A question came to mind about credit cards and about using credit cards. You know, there's the sort of conventional wisdom out there that says you really need to have a credit card and you need to sort of manage your credit card in a certain way in order to maintain a good credit rating. At the same time, with the financial situation being what it is, the banks have changed their policies in many ways. I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago and sat next to a gentleman who is one of these people who makes good money and pays his credit card off on time and didn't really carry much of a balance, but then all of a sudden found his credit card limit reduced to the amount that he currently had on the card, so that all of a sudden, for the purposes of his credit rating, it looked as though he had maxed out his cards. And so that brought on a conversation about how to strategize using credit cards in this current financial situation. So what thoughts might you have on that?
Absolutely. Well, this one is interesting because you can't say, well, you shouldn't have used it in the first place, but you have to start thinking, like, I have to stop using it. You have to understand what a credit card is and what it's doing. It's just truly inflating your income. Now, if you tell me, okay, well, I need it for emergency purposes or I only use it for emergency purposes, okay, fine, no problem. If once you take a look at the numbers, you can actually see that, like you can see that the credit card is only being used for emergency purposes, great. But 90% of the time, that is not the case, you know. Oh, I needed a shirt for the work event. It's not an emergency. I didn't have any cash on me and I didn't want to go to the ATM and get charged, so I used a credit card. That's not necessarily an emergency. Those are conveniences. And so the credit card inflates the income and makes it seem as though we need to use it, but we really don't. So the strategy that I encourage people to do comes right back around to the basics. Take a budget, create one, understand where your money is going, and if you realize it's going on credit card payments, you're using the credit card too much. It's your behavior you've got to change. That'll then improve the situation because the debt is on, it's going to be there. So we have to just face the fact that the debt is going to be here. They're cutting, they are cutting limits, and part of it is to protect themselves, but also why borrow money from someone to purchase something that if you had the cash for it, you could have paid for it? Or if you didn't have the cash, that meant you couldn't afford it. So that's really going back to the basics. Wait a second. What is a credit card again? Okay, it's borrowed money. Do I really need to borrow, you know, $30 to make this purchase? Do I really need to borrow $150 to buy this gadget? Do I really need to? So we have to start. That's one technique, you know, start asking yourself, do I really need to borrow X amount to purchase this thing? Once you stop using the credit card, and your credit card statements tell you this, it's part of a new regulation, a federal regulation, credit card companies have to tell you how long it would take to pay off the current debt if you made absolutely no more purchases, but the interest accrued and you made the minimum payment only. For a lot of people, they can have $5,000 worth of debt on a credit card, and paying their minimum payment, it would take them 19 to 27 years to pay off
Wow.
their debt. Now, that's ridiculous.
Wow.
That's the livelihood of a child that for $5,000. So that gives you the perspective to say, okay, if that's how long it's going to take me to pay off $5,000, it's not worth borrowing the money from you because you're going to have me paying whopping loads of money in interest. That's not a deal I'll take for anyone who is standing in front of me. And we got to start looking at the credit card companies just like that. A person who's standing in front of you who's got $10,000 who's saying, look, I'll let you borrow a little bit at a time, but I'm going to charge you every time you do it. Just ask yourself, do I really need to borrow X amount to pay for this purchase?
Wow. Wow. You know, as you were talking again, questions keep popping up in my head. I'm going to go to a caller in the 909 area code, but at some point I might ask you to explain in really simple terms what compound interest is. But before
Absolutely.
Right, but before we get to that, there's a caller in the 909 area code with the 252 exchange in the 909 area code. I'm going to put you on the air. Caller, are you there?
Yes, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for joining the show. We have our guest here, of course, Dominique Reese, who is a financial advisor, and it's an opportunity for you to ask a question. So what's your question today?
Yes, hi, Ms. Reese. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. You know, first of all, I just want to say thank you so much for what you're doing, because there are a few people who have your experience who are going back to the community and are willing to work with people who aren't in the $100,000 to $500,000 investment range.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. That's exactly what we're there for.
Well, thanks. I wanted to ask two questions. The first one was, you mentioned that when you were with, I think it was it Merrill Lynch? Or
yes.
The people there were investing like from $100,000. With your company, what amounts do people invest, or what, you know, what amounts do you guys work with?
Absolutely. Well, one, Communitree is a financial literacy business, so we don't even invest. We're not an investment firm. We just provide the very basics, which would be counseling and education around budgeting, emergency fund strategies, and debt reduction strategies. I work specifically with single-parent families, low-income families, and households with income less than $100,000. So that's how we usually categorize our clients. And most of the time, you know, incomes usually range from anywhere from $50,000 to $70,000, but also parents who are single parent, you know, have hourly wage jobs, and could also be low income. So receiving some type of government or, you know, city benefits or some type of assistance, EBT or, you know, cash assistance from the government. So we try to cover those three particular income ranges and particular populations so that we really are covering that market, that that middle market that's completely being overlooked by the big guys.
Okay. And how much do you charge for your service?
So our individual money management counseling service is only $140. What that includes is a budget, an emergency fund strategy, and a debt reduction strategy. Based on the client, if they have not pulled their credit report, we also pull their credit report, and we do that free, which any client could do themselves as well, and we show you how, but we do that free using annualcreditreport.com. So that's also included in the service if the client hasn't already pulled their credit report. But it's only $140, three services all in one. Once that contract is up, you can come back to us 6 months later and say, hey, you know, I want to take another look. It'll be another $140. Everything is a one-time transaction. There's no ongoing fees. However, we are about to launch a new program, which is $50 a month for the ongoing counseling for 6 months. So during that 6 months, the client can say, well, I've got my budget now. I've got my fund strategy. I've got my debt strategy. But I just want to check in every now and again. I may have some questions. You know, I may get a letter in the mail saying something about something. I don't know what's going on. I may want to call you, share the situation, and get your counsel. So we're also going to be launching a program like that for $50 for 6 months. So that's also like a one-time fee. It's not $50 a month. It's just $50 for 6 months. But the traditional classic service, just $140 for the three services.
Okay, and do you work with people, like, around the country? Do you do it by phone, or do we have to be where you are?
No, that's the great thing about Communitree LLC. I actually have clients across the country. The way that we work with our clients is that, you know, usually someone finds out about us. We do a free 30-minute consultation via phone, or it could even be via telewebinar. We could set that up as well. So we do the consultation to be sure that we understand your needs, but then to also be sure that we can help you, because if your situation is something that we can't help you with, we will not take on the client. We'll basically refer you to a different service or other financial professionals who may be able to assist you. So once we decide if we can help you and, you know, we understand your needs, we create the contract, and the contract is based on the conversation that we had in the consultation. We send that to you via email. You look that over, make sure it feels good, smells good, looks good, and completely reflects the conversation that we had during the consultation, specifying what the needs are and how we're going to address those needs. Once that looks good, you sign it, you get it back to us either via mail or you can even, put it in PDF form and email it. And then in addition to the contract, the payment can be paid. We're doing PayPal now and also via check, so either via check or via PayPal. You send the payment with the contract, and you also send us the past 90 days of your online banking account. That allows for us to create the budget, see where you are, and show you what you've been doing for the past 90 days. From that, we then project a budget that we think is appropriate for you moving forward. Now, the statements can be sent via mail, via email, whatever is most comfortable for you. We also sometimes get access from our clients. So, we have a confidentiality clause. They give us access to the online account. We go in, print the statements, do our thing. And then after we create the budget for the client, there's usually a week turnaround. We schedule a two-hour call. We send you the budget. We send you the emergency fund strategy. We send you the debt reduction strategy. And you have everything in a PowerPoint presentation, so it's easily accessible, and then an Excel spreadsheet. So now you have a budget and a template that you can go and continue to use on your own. You've got the template. You've got your numbers. We review that in detail. We tell you why we did certain things. We looked at this. We saw your behavior as this. So there's an analysis, and then there's the actual budget. We do that. It usually takes about an hour and a half or 2 hours sometimes, but usually an hour and a half. Go through everything. Client asks any questions. And from there, it's on the client to start implementing. We give strategies on implementing. And like I said, we're going to roll out the ongoing counseling. So that will be another way to help reiterate the behavior that needs to be changed in order to accomplish the goals that we set. And from there, it's a wrap. So that's how we work with our clients from beginning to end.
Wow, that sounds wonderful. That sounds like a really great, well-put-together plan.
Thank you. And it's based on behavior. We want to be sure that, it's only $140, but we want to make sure it works. This is a model we've been working on, and if you give the people the information about what's happening, it's staggering for them. They've probably never seen it that way. They take a deeper look, and then it's like, okay, I can do this, but I may need a little help. I may need a little coaching. I may need a little counseling along the way. Somebody put a little fire under me, or get me back in line, or send me that encouraging text message every now and again. And those are the types of things that we do. So strictly based on changing the behavior modification.
Now, well, that's a comprehensive service that you have explained there. And for people who could never have imagined themselves being able to get help from a financial advisor, your company certainly makes it available to them. Caller, thank you so much for the very intelligent questions that you asked. Every single one of them brought more from Dominique that I think was really helpful to our callers. So I thank you for calling in. I do need to move on to another caller and another question. We have a question actually from Facebook. So I've popped back and forth between Facebook and the chat room and here on Blog Talk Radio on my screen here. And this is a question about a 401k. So in a situation where a person needs to take out a loan, would it be better to take out a loan from a bank, a personal loan, to pay some bills, or is it better to take out a 401k loan, a loan from your 401k? And the person was saying, perhaps with a 401k there might be some strategy involved there, because when you pay yourself back, you pay yourself back with interest.
Absolutely. Well, this is interesting because this is on that borderline of, counsel and advice. And we don't provide investment advice. So, one, I would say if you're not already working with a financial professional, you definitely want to seek one before you make that decision. However, if you were our client and you were coming to us with a situation where you were behind on bills and or you needed to make a substantial payment and you had a 401k to consider, we would do everything in our power to not consider dipping into that 401k. One, because, yes, there is a strategy that you could create to do it such that you pay yourself if you borrow and you don't incur any fees. There is a strategy. Well, when I say incur any fees, I mean any fees beyond the interest that you'd be paying yourself back. Mm-hmm. But there is a strategy that could be created around that, and you would want to seek a professional first. However, we would deter you from that particular option because we want to see why you got in the situation to begin with. Because if you dip into the 401k, you pay it off, you're not addressing what got you there. So it very well can happen again. And if it did, what are you going to do? Dip into your 401k again? You know, that may not even be an option. So you want to really take a critical look at how did I get here and what are these bills? Let's list them out. Let's enumerate everything that's going on. What are their amounts? And we need to get on the phone and start dialing. Very basic things. We need to be in communication with the creditors, understand what these bills are. If we can try and negotiate a lower payment, you know, so it's more affordable for our budget, that's what we need to do. If it doesn't matter how much lower the payment gets, we just cannot make it, then we need to make that known to the creditor as well, and maybe we settle for a different amount. You know, there are other ways you can go about getting rid of debt or paying off these bills that really include taking a look at your budget, where can you pull more money from, but also let's get back to communicating. Dial up your creditors. Tell them what's happening. They rather have something from you than nothing from you. And at the same token, if you let them know this is what's happening and it's just not going to happen any other way, I need you to work with me, most of the time they'll find some strategy to help you with that. And that could be much better than dipping into a 401k, especially in an environment where your job is not promised to you. You could possibly be let go, and at that point, you may have to pay back the loan in full. That would really put strain on your finances then and create a completely different set of stresses.
So let me,
we would avoid that altogether.
Right. Let me interject here for a second because you just said something that had my eyebrows going up. So if you have borrowed from your 401k plan and you happen to lose your job, you then have to pay back what you owe to the 401k plan right then?
You may not have to, but it could trigger that option. That is something that they will include in the fine print of the promissory note. So because I know from personal experience, I've borrowed against my 401k, and luckily I paid it back before I was laid off. But it did include a line in there that, you know, if you lose your job, you could possibly have to pay this loan back in full within a certain amount of time rather than just on the payment schedule. So you don't want to trigger any of those fine print clauses because if they do, that's going to put a much more strain on your budget than borrowing the money in the first place. So once again, going back to the education, you can borrow against your 401k online. You know, there's a process to do it all online. If you do that, you want to be sure you read all of the fine print because once they say, you know, once you sign or do the electronic signature, their assumption is you knew about this. And if you didn't read those promissory notes in full, I don't care how many pages they are, then you're subject to that. There is no I didn't know or it wasn't included. So it definitely can happen, and before you put yourself in a situation, you know, read through it and really try not to even go there because, like I said, you never know when your job is not going to be your job anymore.
Wow. Wow. And listen,
yes.
Speaking of the fine print, the issue of compound interest is one that affects anybody who borrows, especially with credit cards. You know, we've been talking about credit cards, and then there's this borrowing against the 401k and reading the fine print there. But tell us a bit about how compound interest works.
Yeah, so it's a good thing, and it could be, no, I'll say this, it could work in your favor and it could work against you.
Okay.
And that's obviously when you're being paid and you're being paid interest, it works in your favor. But when you're borrowing, it doesn't work in your favor, and that's with credit cards and loans. So compound interest is this idea that if I give you my money, meaning like a bank or even a person, if I put my money away in some investment, in some vehicle that's going to pay interest. Interest is going to grow at a rate which could be daily, it could be weekly, it could be monthly, it could be quarterly, it could be semi-annually, or it could be yearly. So these are the different rates at which you can grow money on your money. And whatever, depending on whichever rate that is, that's, you know, being offered by the bank or the person or the credit card company, you know, how quickly your money will grow. And when your money grows by that particular percentage, so let's just say, for example, you know, I've got $100 and I'm getting paid 10% interest on that. Well, that's going to be $10 at the end of the year if it's 10% interest annually. So basically, at the end of the year, I should have, you know, $110 in my account. Wonderful. I just grew my money by 10%. But now I have $110. So 10% interest is now going to grow on $110, not $100. And that is compound interest. That transaction right there is when you just had compound interest. It's when I've got the first amount of the interest. Now the new interest is going to grow on this new amount, and that's just going to continue to cycle over and over and over again for however long you keep your money in that particular vehicle. Now, as I mentioned, it can work against you in the exact same way. Let's say you got a credit card. It's brand new. You make a $100 payment on that credit card or purchase on that credit card, and the interest is 10%, let's just say, which is extremely low.
In the olden days.
So the interest is 10%. And, you know, over a year, $10 of interest is going to be added to that balance if you don't make any payments. So we're just going to assume the first payment is due at the end of the year. Now, we know our payments are due monthly, which would also mean that the interest is compounded at a different rate. It could be daily. It could be monthly. And for most credit cards, that's they calculate based on the average daily balance. So if every day you have a particular balance on your credit card, that's how much they're using to calculate the interest for that day. And then they do that over the life of the year, so that's 365 days, and that's the particular amount of interest that you're going to have to pay. And it's only going to be incorporated into the balance. So it's not like an additional payment. You know, we make those interest payments in our monthly payments when we do not pay off our credit cards in full. So that's how it can work against you. It's just going to accumulate at whatever rate is set, and then you'll be paying that interest back for the money that they borrow, that they allowed you to borrow.
Wow. You know, the more that you talk about this, the crazier using a credit card seems.
Absolutely. I mean, literally, what is it? It is a way for me to borrow money from someone. But do I need to borrow money to do certain things that if I either saved for or I created a budget around, I would not have to borrow?
But what happens? Well, I'm sorry to jump in on you here, but what happens when you want to, let's say, purchase a house or you need to take out a student loan? We've talked about student loans a little bit earlier, and you need to establish that you have a good credit rating. I mean, my initial thought in hearing you talk about this is, well, why shouldn't I just live a cash-based life? Why should I have a credit card at all? On the other hand, there's this dilemma of what happens when you want to make a really large purchase like you know, buying a house. So is it absolutely necessary for a person to have a credit card?
I usually answer that question by saying, in our economy, in our way of using money and how we facilitate transactions, yes, you have to have one in order to facilitate certain transactions. Now, if we realize that instead of I need it to borrow, then it changes the way, it changes the relationship we have with the card. The card is then used to facilitate transactions, and that's the only time I use it. For example, renting a car, a rental car, if you're traveling, you need a credit card. So using the credit card for things like that when you kind of need it, because they establish your credit worthiness. They use your credit worthiness to establish whether or not they're going to rent you the car. You really don't have any other option. And the same with, you know, renting an apartment. Sometimes, you know, they look at your credit report, and your credit report is a document that basically establishes your credit worthiness. So that would mean you have to have some credit in order to, you know, be determined if you're credit worthy or not. So you do need credit. How you build it is where you can create different options. A credit card is one way to build your credit and to demonstrate your credit worthiness. However, if you use it irresponsibly, it is directly in opposition for what you're trying to do. Realize that. Secondly, when you use the credit card to build credit worthiness, not to borrow per se, it allows you to then get better rates on things like the house and the car that you're trying to purchase, and maybe you do need to finance. You know, I don't think most people have, you know, 20, 50 grand sitting in their account ready to be used for a down payment. However, if they do, that's great. But most people don't. And so at that point, you do need to borrow money. You need to borrow a substantial amount, and they look at your credit report, and the credit report is then, you know, should have some credit. And that's where you have to understand the credit card is used to facilitate transactions that can demonstrate my credit worthiness, not just be used to borrow things and to for the conveniences of life. But even if you do use it for the conveniences of life, responsibility has to be the main factor. It can't just be for the pure enjoyment of the TV. It can't just be for the pure enjoyment of the vacation, because you can save for a TV. You can save for a vacation. You may not be able to save for a car because of the time that it takes. But even still, you know, you have to be sure that once you swipe that card, you're able to pay that balance off in full before they charge you interest on it over that 30-day period, or sometimes 25-day, depending on what the billing cycle is. One should know that as well. Because if it's after 25 days that they start charging you interest, then you need to be sure you pay it off within 25 days, not 31 or 30. But also, if you can't get it paid in 1 month, give yourself at least 2 to 3 months. Why 2 to 3 months? Because 3 months is a quarter. Certain changes on your credit report happen quarterly. You know, by the next quarter, you may have had something that affects your credit report or your credit score. So it could have gone up, it could have gone down. If you can get these big purchases that are on your credit card paid off within that 2 to 3 month period, that still will help demonstrate your credit worthiness, and it can show an impact because of the quarter period. So that next quarter, you may see an increase, may see a decrease. That'll give you some affirmation or some indication of whether that behavior was good or not. And if your credit score goes up, you know, you're demonstrating credit worthiness, paying on time, paying in full, not being late, not triggering any late fees. You're using your card responsibly. You're doing exactly what you should do. You're putting yourself in a better position to get the better rate on the house that you need to borrow money for, on the car that you need to borrow money for. So it all makes sense now. It's just not reckless, irresponsible behavior. It's all for a purpose.
So the two things I'm hearing out of this is that a credit card can be a useful tool, or it can be a noose that
yes.
basically hangs you financially. It's all about having the education and the financial savvy to be able to know how to use the credit card. And then the other thing that seems to be really important is actually reading that fine print that comes with your
yes.
credit card statement, or that came when you got your credit card, that a lot of really important information, vital information, is in that fine print.
Yes, and
right.
that's one tool that anyone can use to educate themselves for free. You can do your own financial literacy session for free today just by printing out your credit card statement or even your online banking statement, because they're much shorter than they used to be. They're like 2 pages now for most of the online statements. And a lot of it is numbers, but they define the terms. And you may even find out things like, oh, okay, you know, I can make an online payment, but if it's not before 3 o'clock, then it's considered late.
Wow.
So you're thinking, as long as I get the payment in on Friday, I'm good. But no, you might need to get that payment in on Friday before 3 p.m. or before 5 p.m., and it may be a different time zone. It could be Central, could be Pacific. So you want to take a look at those, you know, fine. It is not even fine anymore. I think it's regular font now. I think that was part of the change in the regulation as well. So, you know, it's not, it's an easy read. They made it much more digestible, and you're going to find out some really key things that can prevent you from creating a negative behavior, and then just knowing, you know,
right.
knowing those cutoffs, knowing those deadlines is key.
Right. So you don't have to get out the magnifying glass anymore. That's really great. I know that you tread a fine line between giving advice and giving information. So let me ask this question and see how it can be characterized so that it's about giving advice. I'm sorry, so that it's not giving advice, but it's about giving information. I have a question that has come in about renting versus having a mortgage, buying property. And the question is about whether it makes sense to rent instead of having a mortgage with the assumption that the amount that you pay in rent every month is less than you would pay for a mortgage. Would it make sense to take the amount that you would have been spending on a mortgage and put that into something like a 401k, some other kind of interest-bearing savings account?
I love this question. It is a common question, so there's no. It's one that I can answer with great explanation, so no worries.
Okay.
This is one of those things where I say it comes back to being very personal. Now, the way that question was phrased, one, makes an assumption that there's a part of our money that can be used for one thing and then a part of our money that can be used for another, or that there's some savings that we're creating and we should take that savings and put it into something really good. Well, how would you know which is best for you? By creating a budget. Because the budget tells you, first of all, how much you can even afford to spend, whether it's on rent or a mortgage. Once you figure out what that number is, and it's very simple once you work with someone like our company, or even just sit down and do it yourself, you'll find out what that number is. If you can afford to spend, let's say, you know, $1,600 a month on your living, and depending on what percentage of that is your income, that could be a good thing. Now, if that's more than 30% of your income, that's a decision you may want to look twice at, and maybe even three times at. If $1,600 is 30% or less of your income, then, you know, now you know, okay, I can do this comfortably, and whether I do it as rent or a mortgage is based on preference and goals, not based on need. So the whole idea of renting versus, you know, having a mortgage, well, why are you buying a house? What are the goals around the house? Once again, goal setting. Every financial transaction should have a goal around it, not just, oh, I came into some money, I should buy a house. Well, what would the house be for? And really, is this the best time? Are there other needs that you could address? Or I think I want to buy a house soon, you know. Okay, great. Do you plan on staying in this house for more than 5 years? You know, is this just acting on emotion or achieving some dream? Understand why you're doing it. And then the portion about stocking it away into a 401k. If you're not already stocking something into a 401k, that should be the first thing we address. So the whole idea of renting a mortgage should come second, because the retirement savings is more important than whether or not you live in a house or an apartment. I think one would very much rather know that in retirement they can make a decision to live in a house or an apartment than whether that matters so much now. And what's going to affect your decision when you're in retirement is how much money you're able to live off of, given it's a fixed income. So long-term versus short-term goals and really practical budgeting will help us to even address the renting versus mortgage, because we are going to find out how much we can afford in the first place. And then two, is this renting versus having a mortgage a preference and a goal? Or, you know, is there some strategy around it? So that's how I usually answer a question like that. It's coming back to those basics and understanding, based on your situation, what can you afford to do?
and what goals do you have around either plan?
Excellent. That's a wonderful way of thinking about it, because I think that most people have the sense that they're supposed to have a mortgage rather than rent.
Exactly.
And so
there is no assumption when it comes to your money.
All right. Wow. Well, you know, we're coming down towards the end of the show, and I wanted to make sure that we talked a little bit about children and teaching financial literacy to children. You know, you've been so gracious. You've contributed, Dominic has contributed an article to this month's issue of our e-zine, which is also called The Problem is the Answer. And so there's a part of the article, or the article actually, is about teaching financial literacy to children. And you came up with these ideas that were just so fantastic. And I wondered if you could share some of them with the listeners today and perhaps actually share something that wasn't a part of the article as well. But teaching children financial literacy and getting them started young is really so important.
Absolutely. You know, when it comes to teaching kids about money, I think one of the things we have to realize is that kids know about money a lot earlier than we think they do. And that's usually demonstrated in their desires. You know, you go to the store, you go to a restaurant, you pass a fast food market, a kid usually says, I want that. And once they decide they want something, in my opinion, they need to know what it takes to get it. And they're rather soft lessons that we can teach them to help them understand that idea, but there are ways that we can make it fun as well, you know, fun, educational, and practical, once again, because the goal is to teach the kid the value of a dollar so that when they get their own dollar, they act responsibly. And by acting responsibly, they can then go accomplish the financial goals and dreams that we would have them to accomplish. I'm sorry, go ahead, Batabile.
Well, sure. So what kinds of specific, you said soft lessons. Can you give me an example, or please give me an example of a soft lesson that you might suggest
yes.
a parent use?
Absolutely. So let's say you have a young child, you know, a 3 to 6 year old, because a lot of times 3 year olds, they're walking, they're talking, they're pointing, they know what they want, and there are ways that we can start to teach them about money even at three. And I like to do coin identification. You know, coin identification is basically, and I say 3 to 6 year old because, you know, kids start pre-K and kindergarten around six, but sometimes we have some very precocious kids, so 3 years old is not too early. If you're teaching them ABCs, they can learn about numbers. So at three, you do coin ID, and that's, you know, taking all the coins, so the quarter, a dime, a nickel, a penny, and you can even introduce, you know, a dollar coin or a 50-cent piece if you'd like. But introduce these coins to the child, get a blank piece of paper, and trace the coins. In kindergarten, they do tracing. So it's right along, you know, the lines of how to teach kids, but also doing things that are familiar to help them learn about money. So they trace the coins, and then you can write, you know, this is a quarter, over the quarter, write 25 cents in the actual shape of the quarter, and then write the dollar sign 0.25 underneath the quarter. So now you've identified this coin, this circular thing, three different ways to the kid, and depending on the age of the kid and, you know, their level of skill, you can go through those exercises. Here's the quarter. This is one amount to write it. Here's a different way to write it, different ways to write 25 cents. You do that for each coin, and then you can make it fun by coloring. You know, break out the crayons, the color pencils. Let the kid be imaginative. Hey, if they want yellow coins, let them color yellow coins. If they want brown, let them do brown. But, you know, have them color in the coins. It's another exercise that could just be fun. And then also do the same with the dollar bill or the $5 bill. You know, trace it out, write the amounts in, and you can really step it up a level depending on the age of the child by, you know, asking who's on the dollar bill, who's on the coins, teaching about the president. So that's another lesson that you can do, throw in a little history. So that's a soft lesson. You know, it's not all in your face. It's not heavy duty. You haven't introduced the calculator yet, but it's just one way to get the kid familiar with the currency. What does money look like? You say you want ice cream. Well, here's what you got to present in order to get ice cream. You say you want the Power Ranger. Well, here's what you've got to present in order to get the Power Ranger. And you teach them that money is a medium of, used as a medium of exchange. We give it to get something. Very simple idea. Doesn't cost you any money. And you can do it as often as you like whenever the kid is saying they want something. You introduce that idea. So that's one way for young kids.
Well, you know, you brought up something that is actually kind of funny. When I was planning this show, I was talking to my mom about it, and I told her the title of the show is "It's All About the Benjamins." And she said, "What?" She didn't know what I was talking about. And so I'm figuring that there might be a bunch of people out there who are listening, a critical mass of people who are listening, who are totally and utterly confused about the title of the show. They know that it's meant to be catchy, but don't understand why I call the show "It's All About the Benjamins." Why did I call it "All About the Benjamins"?
Well, obviously, Benjamin Franklin, you know, right?
Benjamin Franklin, that's right. He's on the $100 bill.
He's
on the $100 bill. And there's a song by Jay-Z by that title, right?
Yeah, there's a few songs that include that phrase. And that's a lesson right there. You know, people, and those aren't things that necessarily come up in life, you know, unless you're on a game show and it's like the $64,000 question. But nevertheless, it pays to teach kids, you know, these things and really get them familiar with what money looks like and what, you know, what does it do and what is the value, understanding value system as well. Ones versus fives versus tens. I can get this much for this amount and only this much for that amount. Which one would you take? You know, so it may seem elementary, but it can definitely be a powerful way to introduce money to younger kids and kids of any age, honestly.
Right. Well, listen, we're coming down to about the last 5 minutes of the show. So I wondered whether you could give an example for older kids, perhaps tweens or young teenagers. What kinds of soft lessons might a parent use for them?
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, depending on the age of the child, if you've got an allowance going for your child, and even if you don't, this could be an opportunity to create one, because having an allowance, as it did for me, it really opened my eyes to choice. And I think financial behavior is definitely driven by decisions and choice. When it comes down to it, you give your child a certain amount of money, and they have to earn it. And it's not for good grades, you know. That's irrelevant. They should be getting into good grades. But do manual labor, you know, the chores around the house, or even things that are kind of out of the box. Let's say you know your child needs to work on something, and it's not necessarily tied to school. You know, looking at the type of child you're raising and the type of child that you want to raise and produce, you know, encourage them to work on certain parts of their character, their personality. And if they do that, you can incentivize them with money. And one way to do that is to say, okay, we'll open up a bank account. And, you know, based on your allowance, if they have one already, or you can initiate an allowance program, per se, create an incentive for doing certain tasks. If they do that task, you give them the money. Once you give them the money, take it up a notch. Say, I'll even match what you put away, if you put away a certain amount. And that's when it gets really good for the kid, because, you know, teenagers have a lot that they want to spend money on. And when you say match, that's basically doubling their money, which means it's allowing them to get whatever it is they want a lot quicker than it would if they were just saving on their own. So now there's some competitiveness around this idea of savings. But you allow them to save for something that they want, create an allowance program for them, and then match it. The same way the banks, you know, market us. That's basically what happens. And here's one way for you to really teach your child, which is a personal experience, but also throw in, you know, more personal aspects of it. You know what your child is good at and what they aren't good at. So there's one way to work on it with them, incentivize them, and then match it, help them accelerate their savings goals, and not even mention the whole idea of financial literacy. So they'll be learning about it, but getting what they want, becoming a better person, and now you've just instilled more than one skill in them, even though it started with one agenda.
Wow. You know, the opportunities to instill good financial habits in young people. Parents do so much to set their kids up basically for life. And so, you know, it's great that you're coming forward with these ideas to get the idea of financial health and financial literacy in the minds of young people early on when their minds are open and they can make things into habits so that they're not trying to, they're not struggling to develop good habits later on in life. You know, I know that you had other suggestions and they are in the e-zine, which is available through my website when we publish it, and I'll be sending out notices once it is published. And, of course, the website is www.123untangled.com. But for Dominique, if you want to reach her, you know, I'm getting wonderful feedback from folks who are listening. I've gotten into the chat room and on Facebook. And I'm going to take a second and talk about the chat room for a second. I'm getting messages from you that some of you are having trouble getting into the chat room. Really sorry about that. We're going to work with Blog Talk Radio to figure out what it is that's going on about that. But the feedback that I'm getting is so wonderful, Dominique. People are asking, in fact, begging for me to invite you to come back another time. Would you do that?
Absolutely. I'd love to come back.
That would be great. And in the meanwhile, could you tell the listeners how they can contact you if they want to work with you on an individual basis?
Absolutely. So we do have a website. It's www.yourcommunitree.com. So that's YourCommunitree, yourcommunitree.com. That's our website. You can find out more about our company, how we work with our clients, and there's also some links on there and email addresses. However, you can also reach us via phone. Our office number is 347-746-8733. You can reach me directly via email at Dominique, D-O-M-I-N-I-Q-U-E, dot Reese, R-E-E-S-E, at yourcommunitree.com. That's my direct email, so any inquiries you have can come directly to me. And then lastly, we're located and headquartered in New York City. Our office is 394 Broadway, 5th floor, New York, New York, 113. So those are all the ways you can reach us. We're also on Facebook at Communitree LLC, and you can follow us on Twitter at Communitree LLC.
Fantastic. So lots of ways to communicate, and I'll be sure to get that information available to folks. If you contact me, if you were not able to write down this information, you can contact me through Blog Talk Radio, send me a message, and I'll make sure to get that information to you. Dominique, thank you so much for joining us. And folks, listen, if you have enjoyed what you heard today and it's great information, don't leave your friends and family in the dark about it. Share it with them. Let them know that they can listen to the show, the archived version of the show here on Blog Talk Radio. And we will be sure to plan shows in the future that you'll find to be just as helpful. It is our aim to be helpful to you. Thank you so much for joining us this week. I'm looking forward to having you again next week here on the radio, as we discover why the problem is the answer. We're going to leave now with Malika Zahra again, and the name of the album is called The Ebony Road. Her new album is coming out next month, and it will be available, I'm sure, on iTunes and perhaps on Amazon.com. And for you, those of you who are here in New York City, be sure to catch her at the Jazz Standard on the 19th of April. All right, that's it for the week. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
running. You may be losing, running. Don't leave him behind. Thank you.